There was an almighty jolt, then what felt like the world's biggest dog pulling on its lead. I held on to the jacket sleeve like a man possessed. "Kick, Sarah, kick!" She didn't need telling twice. The combination of her efforts and the pendulum effect of the current swept her in towards the bank like a hooked fish. I got to my feet and managed to reel in two more twists of the jacket, taking a few steps towards the end of the bridge. By the time I reached the bank, I had hands full of jeans. I dropped to the ground above her, and we linked arms. She didn't need to be told what to do next. I heaved and rolled, and she used my body as a climbing frame. A moment later, and she was lying beside me on solid ground. I thanked whichever guardian angel was looking over me that day. She was coughing and fighting for breath. She wasn't going to be in any condition to help herself for a little while, and we had to get away from here. I hauled myself to my feet, bent down and scooped her up in a fireman's lift over my shoulder. I picked up the knotted jeans and jacket as I moved off, staggering more than running into the trees. I needed us to be out of sight of the helicopter, and to find some shelter. Ahead of me was a steep rise. I put her down while I got some breath back. I was shivering violently, and Sarah moaned as she, too, fought the cold and shock. I wanted to get beyond the rise into another lot of dead ground, so we couldn't be seen from the other side of the river. Her head lolled over my shoulder, her face close to mine. I was looking straight ahead and focusing on the trees, but I still heard the words. "Thank you, Nick." I tilted my head towards her and did my best to shrug. It felt strange to be thanked like this, and for the second time. Safely inside the tree line, I stopped and helped her to the ground. I turned away and leaned against the tree, my lungs greedily sucking in air. "Can you manage on your own?" I asked. To my surprise, the reply came from very close. I felt her hand on my shoulder as she said, "I can do it. Let's go." I moved off with her following over the rise and onto dead ground. We couldn't be seen from the opposite bank anymore, but we still needed cover from the air and the biting wind. It wasn't as strong as last night, but wind chill could really slow us down after what we'd just been through. Normally, when looking for shelter from the elements, the last place you want to be is in a valley bottom or a deep hollow, because hot air rises, but we needed the cover. We also needed to try and find a place where we could preserve what little body warmth we had left, and away from the noise of the river so I could listen out for pursuers. As I bustled her through the canopy, needles pushed themselves sharply into my face, and bucketfuls of water spilled off the disturbed branches. The best hide I could find was a massive fir about 100 meters from the river, whose branches hung down to the ground. Sarah was clearly in pain as she crawled towards the base of the trunk. The branches started about a meter up the trunk and met the ground about a meter away from us. There was no noise here, except for the wind against the outer branches. It was just as wet inside as out, but it felt wonderful just to be under cover. It's a psychological thing. Get up against or under something, and you begin to imagine you're a bit warmer. We huddled against the trunk, both of us shivering and shuddering. Adrenaline had kicked in when we were on the move, but its effects were subsiding. I just wanted to lie there. But I knew that if I made an effort, it would pay off. I pulled the strap of Sarah's bag over my head and dropped it on the ground. Then I took out the knots with cold, numb, and very fumbling hands and teeth. With my foot on the collar of the jacket, I got hold of the rest of it and started to twist out the worst of the water. Sarah looked at me like an abused puppy, huddled up and shivering. I untwisted the jacket and threw it at her. I wanted her to stay alive for two reasons now. I still didn't want to have to carry a dead weight out of the area. And I wanted her to answer some questions. She put the jacket around her shoulders and hungrily wrapped herself up in it. Then she wriggled backwards until she was resting against the tree, cuddling herself, trying to tuck the jacket around her legs. I took off my shirt and T-shirt, and wrung them out too. I was shivering so badly that it felt as if my muscles were in spasm, but it had to be done. I had to get the water out and some air into the fibres so that my body heat, what was left of it, could sustain itself. Not that cotton has that many air pockets. Cotton kills, the saying goes in outdoor circles. And for good reason. But what I was doing was better than nothing. It made me think of shirts, KF. The thick, woolly shirts we had to wear in the infantry. I'd never found out what the letters KF stood for. All I knew was that the material used to itch and scratch, and in summer make you feel as if you were wearing a greatcoat. But in the field during winter they were great. Wet or dry, the fibres retained heat. I put the shirt and T-shirt back on, then knelt to take off my boots, fumbling to undo the laces with numb, trembling fingers. Finally, I wrung out my jeans, taking care to keep the pistol away from Sarah's grasp. When I was dressed again, I tucked everything in, trying to minimise the number of ways in which the wind could get to me. I pushed the pistol into the back of my jeans by the base of my spine, where she wouldn't be able to get at it. I sat back against the trunk, with Sarah on my left. She was still in the same position as before, sitting in a curled-up ball and using the jacket as best she could to keep herself warm, her hands keeping the collar pulled up around her face. It's always best to share body warmth. And two people of opposite sexes huddled together generate 5% more warmth than two of the same sex. I nudged her with my elbow, held out my arms and motioned with my head for her to move over. She shuffled across, sniffing, her hair soaking wet and plastered over her face. High above, a strong gust of wind made the tree sway. I straightened my legs, and she arranged herself in my lap with her left side against me. Then I lifted my legs to press her closer to my chest, which insulated her from the ground, and got more of her skin in contact with mine. Her wet hair was over my shoulder as her body pushed into mine. I put my arms around her. Neither of us could control our shivering. She snuggled into me, her head against my chest, and I could feel the benefit almost immediately. There was a silence, during which we both willed ourselves to get warm. I looked down on her wet, muddy hair, flecked with pine needles and bits of bark. It almost took me by surprise when she spoke. "I suppose they told you I'm a runner." Her body was shaking. She didn't move her head for me to see, but I could tell by her tone that her period of compliance was coming to an end. Something like that. I bent my head to listen for any follow-up, and raised my knees more to pull her nearer for warmth.
"And I suppose you believed them. Christ, I've been putting this operation together for over 4 years, Nick. Now it's destroyed by some dunderhead who's sent to fuck me over."
The dunderhead bit pissed me off. 4 years to do what? What operation?
What the fuck are you talking about, Sarah?
Her speech was slow. The tone that of a schoolmistress trying to show patience as she explained simple things to tiny minds. It was only partly working. Her shivering was making her speech disjointed.
4 years to infiltrate deep enough to discover their network in the US and Europe. That's what I am talking about.
Infiltrate who? What? Why didn't London know?
London?
She paused.
The reason London doesn't know is because I don't know who I can tell. I don't know the whole network yet. But the more I learn, the more I know I can't trust anyone.
There was another pause. She intended it to give me time to think, but I left it for her to fill. After pulling the collar up further around her face to fight the cold, she took the hint.
I suppose they sent you to kill me.
Her voice was slightly muffled by the jacket. No. Just to get you back to the UK for questioning. It seems you are becoming an embarrassment. She scoffed at my answer. I could feel her shoulders shaking as she covered her mouth to hide the noise of her coughing laugh.
Ah, London.
The laughter stopped, and the coughing took over. She looked up at me.
Listen, Nick, London have got it wrong. This isn't about embarrassment, for Christ's sake. It's about assassination.
I must have had that vacant expression on my face again, because she reverted to her kindergarten teacher voice.
The team in the house? They were planning a hit on Netanyahu.
To be honest, I didn't really give a shit about Netanyahu, so I couldn't help a grin. The hit has failed. They're all dead, apart from one. Her head started shaking like a mechanical toy. She was deadly serious, or as serious as you can be when all your extremities are purple, including your nose.
No, you're wrong. There are still two more members of the cell. They were going to RV with us at the house today. You don't understand, Nick. It's not a job to them. It's a quest. They will carry on.
There was real frustration in her voice.
Believe me, if Netanyahu dies, you will give a shit. It will change the way you live, Nick. That is, if you do.
I hated all this beating around the bush. It was like being in the middle of a conversation with Lynn and Elizabeth again. What the fuck are you on about, Sarah? She thought for a while, as she buried her head back into the jacket collar. The sound of the rotor blades kicked in to join the wind above us, then died as quickly as it came.
No, not yet. I'm going to keep that as my insurance. I need to make sure you get me out of here. You see, Nick, I don't believe you're here to take me back to London. It must be more important than that, or they wouldn't have sent you.
She was right, of course. I would do exactly the same if I was in her position.
Look, Nick, keep me alive and get me out of here and I'll tell you everything. Don't let them use you. Give me time to prove it.
I hated not having control. I wanted to know more, but at the same time I wasn't so desperate that I would lie awake at night with worry. I didn't reply. I had to think. And I was going to take her out of there anyway, whether she liked it or not. She adjusted her body on my legs and looked up again and stared into my eyes.
Nick, please believe me. I've got involved in something where nobody can be trusted. And I mean nobody.
She kept her eyes locked on mine. She had just opened her mouth to speak again when we both heard the sound of somebody crashing through the trees. Whoever it was wasn't having much luck with their footing. They hit the ground with a loud curse.
Shit!
It was a man's voice. I didn't need to say anything to Sarah. She jumped away from me, and my hand reached for the pistol. The man must have got up, only to fall down again immediately with a grunt as he scrambled to recover.
Oh, fuck! Fuck!
On my hands and knees, I moved slowly to the edge of our hide and pushed my face against the branches. It was the American. He was stumbling around in the mud, his clothes soaking, his moustache looking like a drowned rat. He was heading in our general direction, looking as bedraggled as we were. But he wasn't just running. He was looking for ground sign. He was tracking us. I crawled back to Sarah and whispered in her ear. "It's your American. Go bring him in." She shook her head.
"It won't work."
"Make him."
"He won't fall for it."
"You're the one that needs his clothes, not me." She thought about it, then nodded slowly and took a deep breath. I watched as she turned away from me and crawled out of the hide. I heard her call,
"Lance! Over here! Lance!"
I moved to the opposite side of the tree, pushing back under the branches just in case Sarah decided to become Lance's best friend again. I lay down and brought my pistol up into the aim, the barrel just clearing the branches. I could hear her talking to him as they got nearer. It was Arabic, but spoken rapidly. She was still gobbing off to him at warp speed as she shuffled backwards into the hide. I started to feel vulnerable now. Why was she talking to him like this? I'd already heard him speak English. It could only mean trouble. But fuck it. Whatever she was planning was about to happen. Chapter 19. The first things to appear were his hands, the backs of which were covered in hair and looked way too big for his wrists. Then his head and shoulders, face down to avoid the low branches as he pushed his way in. He was nodding and agreeing with whatever it was that Sarah was saying as she followed him in. He didn't look up until he was right inside the shelter. When he did, he saw me crawling out of the branches opposite him. His eyes widened as he saw the weapon, and he shot a glance back at Sarah, looking for some kind of clarification or reassurance. He looked back at the weapon, then at her again, trying to work it out. After a couple of seconds, he gave a deep sigh and lowered his head, rocking it slowly from side to side. Sarah was level with him now, and jerked her head to indicate for him to crawl forwards a bit more. He did as he was told. She ran her hands underneath his jacket. I watched her like a hawk, ready to react if she tried to grab his weapon and draw down on me. She looked at me and shook her head. I motioned him to move to the left of the hide, and he shuffled over on his hands and knees. I stopped him before he was too close to me, in case he fancied his chances. The black bomber jacket he was wearing had a Harley Davidson motif on the left-hand side and looked warm. I motioned with the pistol. Clothes. Still on his knees, bent over with his back parallel to the ground, he started to remove the jacket. His gaze switched between me and Sarah. He didn't say a word, still trying to work it all out. Sarah was sitting against the tree with her hands in her jacket pockets and her knees against her chest. I grabbed the American's jacket and started to put it on, making sure I put Sarah's bag back over my shoulders. "Now the rest of your stuff," I said. "One hand." He put his left hand on the ground and fiddled with his belt buckle with the other. Sarah was impatient and very cold, and she snapped at him in Arabic. She must have been feeling grim, covered from head to toe with mud, leaves and pine needles, and her legs were wet, dirty and bleeding. Lance was wearing Nike trainers, and Sarah decided to help him by pulling them off from behind. His Levi's were next, and when he'd finished, she stretched out on the ground, arched her back and raised her backside to get the big jeans on. She was doing up the belt and he was pulling off his t-shirt when I heard the helicopter again. The two of us looked up, which was pretty fruitless considering the tree's canopy meant we couldn't see anything. Lance's t-shirt was over his head but not his shoulders. I put my left hand on the back of his neck and rammed his face into the mud, the barrel of my pistol pressing into his neck. The throbbing of the rotors was virtually overhead. The heli was hovering. It stayed there for several seconds, the trees flexing under the downwash. Shape, shine, shadow, silhouette, spacing and movement. Those are the telltales that can betray your location. But we were in good cover. Sarah knew that too, and continued slowly pulling on the warm clothes. The heli moved away about 50 meters, hovered again, then moved on. The sound of its rotor blades disappeared completely. I took the muzzle away from the American's neck and told him to carry on. He finished taking off his T-shirt. Sarah took off the jacket, put on the T-shirt, and replaced the jacket. All that was left were his socks and boxes. It was Lance's turn to shiver, the thick hair on his back plastered flat by the rain. I could see in his eyes that he was starting to flap. He must have thought he was going to be killed, and started mumbling some sort of prayer to himself. But it wasn't a plea. The tone was more of acceptance. I said, "It's okay, Lance. You don't need Allah yet. You're not going to die. Just shut the fuck up." Sarah was sorted. Kneeling with her hands in her jacket pockets, wearing size 11 trainers and jeans with the gusset hanging halfway down to her knees, with turn-ups so big they looked like some sort of fashion statement. The boy was still mumbling away to himself on his knees, bent forward with his forearms resting on the ground, his hands clasped together in prayer. He was trying his best to be the grey man. Sarah looked at me. "What about him?" I said, "Let's get moving while the heli's gone. I'll tie him to the tree with my belt. He'll be fucked off, but he'll live." She shook her head. I said, "No, just leave him. Come on, let's go. We need to make distance." She gave a sigh as I took the belt from the bag and kicked Lance over to the tree and began to secure him to it. An hour or two and he would free himself. If not, he deserved to die anyway. He was still muttering to himself, and as I tightened the knots, he blurted out some insult to Sarah in Arabic. He was probably telling her what a bitch she was for fucking him over like this. After all they had been through together and all that shit. She ignored it. I felt like telling him I knew how he felt. I had a quick look around to check we hadn't left anything, and started to crawl out of the shelter. Sarah followed, or at least I thought she did. The Arabic mumblings got fainter. I was still on my hands and knees, my head just emerging from the branches, when the loud report of a weapon came from behind me. Instinct flattened me to the ground. In almost the same instant, I realized it wasn't me who'd been shot, and slithered out of the way. My first thought was that he'd somehow got Sarah. I jumped to my feet and ran round the tree to approach him from the other side. I started to crawl in, weapon at the ready, pushing through the branches on my stomach. I saw him. He was still being held up by his secured hands, but his body was sagging and his legs were splayed, like the crumpled victim of a firing squad. There was no way Lance would be feeling the cold anymore. Sarah had head-jobbed him with a semi-automatic. She was on her knees putting the weapon into her jacket pocket. What the fuck was it with this woman? Every time she was left alone with a man, she landed up killing him. "Give me the gun, Sarah. Give it." She looked up into the sky, as if I was being boring, pulled it from her pocket and threw it over to me. I crawled back out. It was pointless keeping a low voice now. Half the state would know where we were. I snapped, "What the fuck are you doing?" "He wouldn't stop, believe me. He would try and join up with the other two or carry on himself. I know these people. I know Lance very well. Look, the other two. They know where, how, and when to do the hit. What you did this morning won't stop them." Her face had taken on a manic look. "For fuck's sake, Nick, I'm beginning to wish I'd just killed you and opted to carry on with him." There was no time for debate. We'd been compromised. We had to be like animals now and run as fast as we could. It didn't matter where, we just had to get out of that immediate danger area. Only when we were a safe distance away could I stop and assess. Assuming the shot had been heard, there would be chaos at the police control centre, as it was reported over the radio net. They would just have been starting to work through all their post-incident procedures when, literally, bang, another problem. Initially, they'd be confused, but they'd soon figure out where it had come from, and direct the helicopter and follow up our way. We legged it. We could move much faster now than before, even with Sarah wearing her size 11 Nikes. I was severely pissed off with her for what she'd done, but tried to control it. Once you allow yourself to get angry, you stop concentrating on the aim, which in this case was to make distance. Whether or not she was lying wasn't an issue at the moment. I didn't care. The only thing that mattered right now was escape. The helicopter swooped over the canopy. We stopped in our tracks and took cover beneath the trees. But the aircraft wasn't hovering this time. It was moving fast and low. It crossed directly overhead, blasting torrents of rainwater from the trees onto our heads, then roared away at speed. I decided to keep going in the same direction, a straight line away from the house. I wanted to find a road or some habitation. A house should mean a vehicle. It was fully light now. Our faster pace had got some body warmth going, and if anything, I was starting to overheat. Just like me, Sarah was puffing and panting as we scrabbled up the rises and stumbled headlong downhill. There was no need to explain to her what I was doing. She was actually a help, because it was so much easier to have two sets of eyes and ears. After 30 minutes of hard running, we finally hit a road. It was a single carriageway, potholed and no more than 3 or 4 meters wide. I paralleled it to the right, running through the trees about 10 meters to its side. We hadn't gone far when I heard a vehicle. We stopped, got down, and I rested on my elbows and knees to keep myself out of the mud and preserve body warmth. It was approaching fast from behind us, engine roaring and tires splashing on wet tarmac. A blue and white appeared and sped past, its roof-mounted red and blue light bar flashing brighter than was normal in daylight, because of the cloud cover. The police would have things squared away by now. They were probably placing a cordon round the whole area. They'd then either wait for us to emerge, or come in and flush us out. The moment the cruiser disappeared from view, we got up and started moving. The wind had strengthened, and I could see waves of heavier rain coming in ahead. After 20 minutes of running through deeply rutted, puddled ground, we came to a large open area. A perfect square of about 5 acres cut out of the forest, with a white cattle fence around the perimeter. Sitting in the middle, and approached by a driveway from the road, was a two-story ranch house built of wooden slats, with a pitched roof tiled with grey slates. A square extension had been added onto the far end, and I could see an open garage at ground level. Inside were a pickup truck, 2 other cars, and a small powerboat on a trailer. The building and 2 of the 3 vehicles looked as if they'd seen better days. There was no approach to the garage that avoided open ground. I guessed there would be windows on every side of the house to take advantage of the views. 6 or 7 horses were loose in the field, but there was no evidence of dogs, and the house itself seemed quiet enough. Maybe everybody was still tucked up in bed. "You stay here," I whispered to Sarah. "I'm going to go and get a wagon. When you see me drive out, move up to the road." "Why aren't I coming over with you?" She sounded suspicious, as if she thought I'd get in a vehicle and just leave her stranded. If only she knew. She was in no position to question my decisions, but I answered. "1, it's quieter if I go on my own. I know what I'm doing, you don't. Number two, I don't want you killing anybody else. And number three, you have no choice. I have your documents in here. I half turned to show her the bag on my back. You want me to help you? You wait here. The plot of land was as flat and green as a pool table, not a single fold in the ground. Checking the road for vehicles and the sky for helis, I set off across grass which was about 3 inches high and full of moisture, running but trying to keep as low as possible. I didn't know why, because it didn't make me any less visible, but it just seemed the natural thing to do. I was leaving a clear track in my wake through the wet grass, but I couldn't do anything about that. I kept looking at the windows for movement. As I got closer, I could see that the upstairs curtains were drawn. I wondered if Mr. and Mrs. Redneck were sitting in bed watching the news about last night's events down the road. For sure, there'd be more news crews at the lake by now than there were police. Reaching the house, I bent down below a side window with open curtains. In this weather, there would have been a light on if people were up and about, and there wasn't. But even so, I didn't chance looking inside. I held it there for a few seconds and listened. Nothing. Now that I was close up to them, I could see that the slats weren't wood at all, but aluminium painted to look that way, and the roof was just felt, masquerading as tiles. I moved around to the opposite side of the house, towards the garage extension, making sure that I kept low to avoid the windows. I shook my head to get the rain out of my face. There were no wet tire marks on the garage floor or rain on the wagons. There had been no movement since at least last night. The first thing to do was check whether any of the vehicles were alarmed. I couldn't see any warning signs, flashing LEDs or other telltales. An alarm would probably have cost more than the two cars anyway. I tried all the doors on the vehicles, starting with the pickup truck, then the two others. A small, rusting red Dodge, a bit like a bottom of the Range Rover, and an elderly olive green estate car with fake wood panelling along the sides that made it look like a stagecoach. Everything was locked. The rain was drumming on the garage roof as I went back to the muddy white Nissan pickup. It had a double cab, with a flatbed on the back, protected by a shaped, heavy plastic liner. I had a quick mooch in the boxes next to it, against the wall, then moved aside the plastic bottles of two-stroke mix for the boat engine, looking for something to jenny it open with. I found a toolbox, and was bending over it, moving the tools really slowly and carefully so I didn't make any noise. When there was a shout that made me jump.
"Don't move! Freeze, you son of a bitch!"
Whoever it was, he must have spent his life stalking animals in the woods because I hadn't heard a sound. I didn't move a muscle.
"Keep still, or I'll shoot your sorry ass,"
he said in a really cool, calm, deep southern drawl. He was directly behind me. Fucking right I stood still. I also made sure he had a good view of my hands. I had a pistol tucked down the front of my jeans and another in my jacket, but they were staying where they were. I didn't know what he was pointing at me, or even whether he had anything at all, but I wasn't going to take the chance. I stayed bent over the toolbox and kept my mouth shut. I didn't want to say anything that might antagonize him, especially in my bad American accent. I could hear his feet scraping on the concrete floor of the garage. I listened intently. I wanted to estimate how far away he was.
"Son of a bitch, stay where you are."
He sounded an oldish man, maybe in his early 60s. He was shuffling towards me. I moved my eyes so that I could catch his reflection in the door window of the pickup. As he moved closer, I could clearly see an outstretched hand holding a snub-nosed revolver.
"Do you know whose truck this here is, fella?"
I shook my head very slowly.
My son's a state trooper. He's out there, looking for your ass right now. But you're in my house. You belong to me, son's a bitch of shit, damn it.
Either I was right. They had been watching breakfast TV, or Mr. and Mrs. Redneck's little boy had been on the telephone to fill him in on events. He carried on.
The troopers is coming now to drag your ass in, fella. Shit. That's my son's truck. He worked dab burn hard for that, motherfucker. Shit.
I kept watching the reflection in the window. He took another couple of steps towards me, but he shouldn't have done. You never get too close to someone when you're holding a pistol. What's the point? It's designed to kill at a distance. Another step, and I could see the detail of the weapon. It was a 38, the same type as the young black guy had been buying at Jim's, as the salesman had told him.
Just point it like your finger at the center mass, and it will take them down.
The hammer was back, which wasn't good for me. Revolvers work on a double action. To fire, you have to make a very positive squeeze on the trigger, which works both actions, pulling the hammer all the way back and letting it then go forward. That serves as the safety device on a revolver, instead of having a safety catch, which you get on most semi-automatics. But he'd cocked it. The hammer was pulled back. The first action had already been taken up. All he had to do now was gently squeeze that trigger with less than 7 pounds of pressure, and the thing would go off. A year-old baby can exert 7 pounds of pressure with his index finger, and this was a big old boy who was pissed off and sparked up. I remained passive. He had me. What could I say? The reflection moved and he was almost on top of me, and then I felt cold metal in the back of my neck. He jabbed the pistol, moving it up and down, and knowing that he had his finger on the trigger, I started to flap. I closed my eyes, ready to die.
"Fucking sons of fucking bitches,"
he ranted.
"Why don't you fucks get a job like every other motherfucker? Shit. Not just come and take. You're not gonna take here."
I opened my eyes and looked in the window. He had his arm fully extended and the muzzle was still in contact with my neck. Either he was going to kill me by accident if that second pressure was pulled, or I was going to get fucked over well and truly once the son and his trooper mates arrived on the scene. If I was quick enough on the initial move, I'd be safe for a second. It was what I did afterwards that would decide whether or not I lived. I was going to get caught or I was going to die, so anything I did before that was a bonus. I didn't want him to see me taking the 3 deep breaths to fill my lungs with oxygen, so I just let him get on with jabbing the muzzle into my neck while I closed my eyes and got ready. He cackled at his own humour as he said,
"My son's gonna kick your sorry ass, you fuck."
He was getting more angry as he gained confidence.
"Why is you here doing your killing? Get home and do your killing there. Shit."
He was thinking of something to add. He found it.
"Sons of bitches."
I took the final breath and opened my eyes.
"Fuck it. Just go for it."
Stepping forward with my right foot and at the same time swiveling left on the other, I raised my left arm, bellowing like a lunatic. I was hoping for 2 things, that it would confuse him and that it would also spark me up. It didn't matter to me which part of my left arm hit his weapon arm, as long as it did. My arm connected and I could no longer feel cold metal against my head. My left forearm now had to keep contact with his weapon arm as I carried on swiveling round so that I was facing him. He was bigger than I'd expected. His unshaven face looked like crinkled leather, and it was topped with a riot of uncombed grey hair. I grasped the material of whatever he was wearing on his weapon arm, trying to keep the 38 facing anywhere but at me. A round went off, and the reports echoed around the garage. He probably didn't even realize he had pulled the trigger. I kept turning, and he started to scream back at me and holler for Ruby. His face was no more than 6 inches from mine, and I could smell his bad breath and see his toothless mouth, wide open. For the full 2 seconds my move had taken, my eyes had never left the pistol. In theory, the rules of squash apply. Never take your eye off the ball. But I'd always found it hard. Sometimes I reckoned it was just as effective to look at the other player, because just before he hits the ball, his eyes will tell you if he's bluffing a hard one and is in fact going to hit it gently. It wasn't something I'd been taught. It was just something I found myself doing instinctively in that situation. Maybe that was why I was such a crap squash player. As I turned further, so did he. The look on the old boy's face was not a happy one. A couple of seconds ago, things had been going really well for him. And yet now he thought he was about to meet his maker. His head and body were turning away from me, presenting his back, and with my right hand I was able to slam his head against the wagon. There was a thud on the window as he made contact, with me still gripping what I could now see was the blue overall sleeve on his left arm. I pushed him hard against the pickup with the weight of my whole body, knocking the air out of him. I pushed with my right knee against the back of one of his kneecaps, and he buckled. I held his head to control his fall. I didn't say a word. I didn't have to. He was on his knees, spread-eagled against the wagon, his face pressed against the door. I gripped his weapon arm and shook it. The 38 clattered to the floor. But that wasn't the end of it. This boy wasn't giving up. Spit and blood flew out of his mouth as he raged.
You son of a fucking bitch. That's all you want to do? Come here and take... shit.
I was worried about his wife. Was Ruby on the phone to the police? Or getting out the shotgun? I stepped back and drew my own pistol, kicking his left arm to get him right down on the floor. Then I delivered a couple of persuaders for him to get under the pickup. Now what? I ran. I sprinted out of the garage, turned left past the front of the house, and legged it across the grass, following the track I'd made on the way in. The rain was pelting down. I heard a woman shout behind me, but I didn't look back. There were no shots. I vaulted the fence and made my way through the woods to Sarah. She was on her haunches against a tree. I collapsed next to her, panting on my hands and knees. I looked up and we exchanged a glance. What could I say? I'd fucked up. You can be so close to civilization, yet when you're wet, cold, hungry, and don't exactly know where you are, it can seem so far. There was a gap that she filled. What now? Let me think. I looked back at the house. There was no movement. Ruby was probably in the garage, dragging her husband out from under the pickup before heading back to the phone. My mind was racing through all the options, but the decision was made for me. A cruiser ripped along the road from the opposite side of the house, a blue and white blur in the driving rain. No sirens, no lights. Just a foot flat down on the gas pedal. If it was Mr. and Mrs. Redneck's little boy responding to the call, he wasn't going to be happy with the way I'd abused his father's southern hospitality. I got up and started to move. They would be following up big time, tracking the sign I'd left in the grass. I ran back the way we had come, then hung a right towards the road. At that moment, I heard the helicopter rattling through the sky. We got into tree-hugging again. The moment it had flown past, and not even bothering to look behind me to check for Sarah, I started motoring through the forest. She would just have to keep up. Reaching the edge of the wood near the road, I dropped onto my hands and knees, watched and listened. The only sounds I could hear were my own laboured breathing and the rain hammering on the tarmac and leaves. Sarah flopped down beside me. I crawled to the very edge of the tree line and looked out. The wet, potholed single carriageway road was deserted. Chapter 20. We both lay there in the mud, lifting our heads and checking for movement, like a pair of meerkats. I couldn't see anything, just solid walls of rain. Finally, I nodded to her. She acknowledged. I got up and sprinted across the road, but instead of going into the tree line, I cut left and started following the edge of the tarmac. She shouted, "Nick, what are you doing? Come on, let's get undercover." I turned and waved her towards me. She hesitated a moment, then understood and ran to join me. I kept to the roadside for another 30 meters, checking backwards, forwards and upwards for movement. I chanced about 10 meters more and knew I was tearing the arse out of it. I ducked to the right and moved into the tree line. Even if they followed up with dogs, it would take them a while to re-establish our trail, for the surface scent would be washed off by the tarmac by the heavy rain, slowing the dogs down severely. It would then be up to the trackers to cast for sign in both directions and along both sides of the road, because for all they knew I might have doubled back. Only when, or if, they refound our trail could they get the dogs back on the scent. For the next half hour I picked my way through dense forest. The ground was undulating and littered with knolls. It was hard going, but excellent cover. The sort of terrain that a light aircraft might crash into and never be found. I was heading in this direction for no other reason than that I wanted to. Sometimes there is no absolutely correct answer. Every 10 minutes or so the heli clattered across the sky, casting around for movement or visible sign. This time, it got a bit too near. We stopped and hid, using the chance to catch our breath. Both of us were still soaked to the skin with rain and sweat. As the heli came in low over us, the trees swayed with a downwash, and another 60 gallons of rain cascaded through the canopy. My throat was dry and rasping as my chest heaved, the only positive thing being that all this effort was keeping my body core nicely heated. Still, the helicopter didn't move out of the area. He was there, somewhere, low and slow. I looked back the way we'd come and saw the ground sign we'd left. It would be easy enough, even for the untrained eye, to follow, but for anybody who knew what they were doing, possibly with dogs, it was a floodlit motorway. Deep down, I knew it wouldn't take them long to find where we'd crossed the road. From there, it would be simple. We were travelling through wet forest, over stinking ground, in rain and fog. Perfect terrain and conditions for keeping a scent glued in position. What was more, they would be following on fresh legs and able to call up reinforcements at will. And after a while, they'd be able to predict our direction of travel so that others could intercept us. Then again, maybe they didn't have dogs or trackers on the case yet. It wasn't as if such things were on 24-hour standby. Visual tracking is not the most popular skill for a person to take up, and exponents are in short supply. Maybe it would take them hours to mobilize somebody, and maybe they lived on the other side of the state. Maybe. Maybe. Whatever. Every man, but hopefully not his dog, would be out looking. I had to admit to myself that I had no idea where we were going, and we were gradually exhausting ourselves. A decision had to be made. Did we hide up and wait until dark to move out of the area, preferably by a vehicle, or did we take our chances now? The heli's blades chopped the air above us. It didn't seem to be going anywhere. This was strange. It wouldn't be able to see a thing under the canopy, and in a backwards area like this it was unlikely to be fitted with thermal imaging equipment. It was a full 10 minutes before I heard a change in engine pitch, and the aircraft rattled off into the distance. I moved from under the tree and continued running. Our pace was slowing perceptibly. I was fucked. My footprints were getting closer and closer together as my strides shortened. To a visual tracker or trained dog, it would be the encouraging sign of a slower-moving quarry. I glanced behind me. Sarah looked like death on legs. I tried to think of positives. If you run at 10 miles per hour for 1 hour in an unknown direction, you could be anywhere in a circle of just over 300 square miles. An hour later, that will have become an area of 1,256 square miles. In the Lone Ranger, Tonto used to stop and say, "Five wagons, 2 hours ago. That way, Kimosabi." Luckily, real life isn't that easy. And Tonto lives in Arizona. I decided to lie up and wait until last light. With no compass or stars to guide us, I could be going round in circles for weeks. During darkness, the plan would be to move to a known quantity, the road, and parallel it until I could get my hands on a vehicle. I carried on for another 10 minutes or so, with Sarah now up with me. About 60 or 70 meters away to my half-right, there was something which looked as if it could work. A fallen tree on higher ground, its branches still intact, but decaying. It had fallen down a sharp bank. It would give us ideal cover from view from the air as well as the ground, and, just as important, it would give us cover from the elements. If the police didn't get hold of us, I didn't want the weather to finish us off. It wouldn't be long before exhaustion and cold would take their toll.
"What are we doing now?" Sarah asked. "Why have you stopped?"
I didn't bother replying. I was looking back at the route we'd taken. Then I turned round again and looked forward at the tree, off to my half-right. The ground ahead was the same as behind, rises with lots of dead ground beyond. I turned half-left and started kicking my feet, leaving obvious sign. I wanted them to see my direction change away from the fallen tree. Sarah followed on behind, puffing and panting, struggling to keep the size 11 trainers on her size 5 feet. Over a rise and in the dead ground beyond was a stream a couple of meters wide. I headed down and waded straight into the freezing water. I checked behind me and couldn't see the tree. Sarah stood her ground on the bank.
"What are you doing?"
"Get in." The water came over my knees. I turned left and moved downstream, stopping every dozen or so paces and looking back to make sure I couldn't see the tree. I had trudged about 50 meters, with Sarah splashing along behind me, before I decided this was far enough. I didn't know why, it just felt right. I got out on the far side of the stream and stood still. I could hear Sarah's trainers squelching as she came up beside me, visibly thankful for the rest. I gave myself a minute to collect my thoughts, looking at her, soaked and bedraggled, fur needles splattered on her face, twigs in her hair. Not exactly how she'd choose to appear at one of her embassy parties, but she was doing well. She'd obviously kept herself in shape. "Ready?" She nodded, and took a deep breath to prepare. We moved up and down for another 300 meters or so, in a direct line away from the stream. Sarah was starting to feel the strain, and I could only move at her speed. I decided that this was far enough. It was time for one last bit of deception. I stopped, and moved over to an outcrop of rock. Sarah came up level with me, and we both had our hands on our knees, panting for breath, as if we'd just finished a 200-meter sprint. "Sarah, take off your knickers." She looked at me blankly. She'd heard me say that before, but not in a situation like this.
What?
Your knickers, I need them. I'd already taken off my jacket and was pulling off my shirt. I was after the T-shirt underneath. Her expression told me that she wasn't sure about this.
Sarah, trust me. They must have dogs.
She didn't bother to ask, just moaned to herself about getting undressed. In any other situation, it would have been quite nice to watch her drop her jeans and peel off her underwear. But that was the story of my life. Wrong time, wrong place. I got my shirt back on and shivered as it touched my skin. Sarah was busy doing up her jeans. I picked up her knickers and placed them with my T-shirt between the rocks and a bush. If we were being tracked visually or by dogs, they would get to this point. The mutt doesn't know what's really happening and what exactly he's looking for. To him, it's just a game. A dog can confuse an item of clothing with the quarry and assume victory with its find. Then the handler has to get the dog sparked up again before it will continue. Dogs pick up scent in two different ways. From the air and from contact with the ground, trees, plants and buildings. Airborne scents don't last long. They are quite quickly blown away by the wind. Ground scent, however, can be obvious to a dog for anything up to 48 hours, and can be generated not only by leaving your smell on things you touch, but by your movement itself. If you're walking on grass or pushing through vegetation, you'll crush leaves and stems with every step. Even on bare ground, your footprints will release air and tiny quantities of moisture which have been trapped in the earth, and they smell quite different from the air above ground. From your scent footprints, a dog can even tell which direction you are moving in. Because as you push off each step with your toes, the front of the scent print is more obvious than the heel. And it doesn't take long for a well-trained dog to work out what that means. Just as each person's footprints look slightly different to the human eye, so does the mixture of scents in a smell footprint to a dog. If he's really switched on, he might even be able to track one individual where there are a number of people travelling together. A dog could out-hear, out-smell and outrun me, but I could outthink him. The strongest odour is from the sweat glands, I said to Sarah. But at the moment, I think your underwear will smell more than your T-shirt. I grinned. Nothing personal. She thought about it and nodded. She had to agree on that one. Okay, follow me, step by step. Don't touch anything, not even to lean on. I started to pick my way over the outcrop, sticking to the highest rocks to keep out of any areas where scent could be trapped. Hopefully they would be washed clean by the rain. We moved into dead ground, carefully picking our way to prevent leaving sign. I started to move back down to the river. I got 75 meters short of the water and moved left until I saw the fallen tree. From nowhere, the heli reappeared. We hurtled under the trees, hugging them as if they were long-lost relations. I heard the groan of the rotors again, moving deliberately over the top of the canopy. It got so close, I could feel the downwash. I suddenly made sense of what it was doing. It was following the line of the stream, maybe patrolling any exposed waterways because that was all they could see down here. It moved off, and so did we. The fallen tree looked quite promising. There were enough branches to hide under, and we could even get under the trunk where it lay clear of the ground. It was going to be a squeeze, but we'd be needing to huddle together anyway to share body heat. Sarah was down on her knees trying to catch her breath. She searched my face as I motioned her in. Why aren't we running? I'll explain later. Just get under cover. She squeezed in and I followed. The underside of the trunk was just as wet and cold as the open air. But we were hidden and had a chance to